this discussion of ethical issues within the Nova Scotia healthcare system during the first wave of COVID response. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist with the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network. And we saw certainly that ethical questions and concerns arose across the healthcare system as we grappled with the many challenges that COVID presented us with. There were, however, areas where these challenges were particularly present and acute. So we've assembled a panel to explore the way that ethical issues arose and were addressed in the context of long-term care, public health, and policy and procedure. So we'll start off this discussion by having the panelists introduce themselves. So I'll go first to Allison.
Thanks, Marika. So I'm Allison Lamb, and currently the Chief Nursing Informatics Officer with the Nova Scotia Health Authority and IWK, and was redeployed to co-chair the Clinical Medical Advisory Committee with Dr. Shelley McNeil and Cindy McCorry as the part of the first wave. That committee has now transitioned into what we call the COVID network. Thank you.
Great. And next we have Gary.
Good morning, Gary O'Toole. I'm the Senior Director for Population and Public Health with the Nova Scotia Health Authority, and I lead the team that is primarily responsible for investigating cases of COVID in Nova Scotia and applying appropriate control measures to stop the spread of disease.
Excellent. And last but not least, Lisa.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Snodgrass. I am the Director of Clinical Practice and the Infection Control Specialist for Shanex and Parkland. We are retirement living and long-term care communities. I'm based in New Brunswick, but I oversee our New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Ontario homes. Thank you.
Wonderful. So welcome all of you to the conversation. So first question for each of you is, in your experience, what were the types of ethical challenges that arose during your work during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, and how were those challenges addressed as they arose? So we'll turn again to Allison to kick us off.
Thanks. So certainly during the first wave of the pandemic, there were many ethical challenges and questions that arose in the work that the Clinical Medical Advisory Committee, better known as CMAC during the first wave, faced. This was a committee that was struck of clinical and medical leadership from across the province, very grassroots, with a significant amount of interest in COVID because that was their daily work. So the committee was addressing issues such as minimizing the risk in the event of code blue with COVID-19 patients or those that were suspected of potentially having COVID, showing risk factors of COVID, things like visitor restriction policies and knowing the importance of having visitors in our organization as the Nova Scotia Health and all our facilities, but also understanding the risk that that brought to the patients and the families and patients. In addition, certainly we've dealt with challenges of what was the potential if we ran out of ventilators and how are we going to make decisions associated with triaging, who would potentially receive intensive care and who would receive other options. Also, some of the other things that we dealt with in collaboration with many other leaders, such as Gary, was when we knew that there was communities within our province that were experiencing increased epidemiological spread of COVID. What did that mean when staff and or patients were coming into our facilities to receive care, and how were we going to address protecting the patients and the staff? So lots of challenging ethical situations where we needed to bring the ethical lens to the discussions we were having because the evidence was ever changing and evolving as we were making decisions, and really understanding how we grounded those decisions to minimize the risk to patients and families and our staff as well as we proceeded through the first wave and now into the second wave. And I think the lens that the ethicists brought were really using those ethical principles in making tough decisions that we didn't always have the right answer for. And we also always didn't have the evidence that we were used to having when we make decisions. So it really allowed us to have some really good conversations and ground our decisions and understand that those decisions could evolve as more information came along.
And so then passing the baton to you, Gary, what did things look like from your end of the situation?
Yeah, there's certainly lots of challenges to draw on in the first wave, and continue to be challenges every day. When I think back about, it seems like it was yesterday in many respects, and it also feels like it was 1,000 years ago. When I think back to March and April, when we were really at the height of, that first wave response and all of the issues, given what Allison just shared about, not necessarily having all the evidence at our fingertips like we normally do when we're investigating communicable diseases, known diseases. I think in this case, it was a novel disease, new, not really sure what its epidemiology was and exactly how it was impacting the population at large. At the time, we were also having to make decisions about how to control it, presented all kinds of challenges. There are two that really stand out for me. One was the need for folks to self-isolate. So people either arriving back in Nova Scotia, if you remember around that time, it was March break. People were returning from far and wide to their homes in Nova Scotia. Travelers were arriving in Nova Scotia really, from all kinds of various global situations. And so that need to self-isolate and the requirements for self-isolation were being imposed around that time appropriately. And we were the deliverers of that message. So in a lot of cases, our staff were giving messages to people who were returning and who potentially were suspect cases of the need to self-isolate. And at the same time, finding out that, a relatively large number of people didn't necessarily have the means to self-isolate in a way that we wanted them to. So either their home environment was not conducive to being in self-isolation, so i.e. a shared bathroom facilities or small living quarters or a shared living quarters made it impossible for some people to self-isolate in a way that we wanted them to. And also there were a number of folks who we interacted with in the first wave that did not have stable housing available to them to do the self-isolation. So that presented all kinds of, I think, ethical considerations for us in how we dealt with cases, how we provided advice and our expectations around control measures for those individuals who did not have that stability in their life to be able to self-isolate in a way that we knew was important to control the spread of disease. So we still grapple with that, and we find that fairly routinely in our work that people don't have necessarily the stable housing environment that is conducive to self-isolation. And so what then, additional supports can we provide to help support them? Another, that is in part how we've addressed some of those issues is, what supports can we rally from across the system to help support those individuals who really need it? The other area that I wanted to speak of just briefly that came up, repeatedly, especially during the first wave, is something that Allison already touched on, and that is the use of data. So, a novel virus in Nova Scotia in a pandemic situation, everybody wants to know where the first case is. Everybody wants to know where in my community are the cases located so that I can avoid them. and so that carries with it the risk of stigmatization and all kinds of other privacy issues. And of course, in healthcare, the protection of personal health information is paramount, and we make every effort to ensure that privacy is respected and that health information is protected. And unsurprisingly, I think when something is new and scary, like a pandemic is and like a new virus is, people want to know and indeed feel like they have the right to know all kinds of details that they don't necessarily have the right to know, because they feel if they know, then they'll be somehow better protected from the disease. And so, one of the ways that we approached that issue was making sure that, there was really good communication across the province around the control measures that people can apply, the social distancing or the physical distancing, the hand washing. And at the time, mask wearing wasn't really a thing, but has become one since. Those measures you can take as an individual to protect yourself, regardless of where disease is in the community, those were really important messages to help us address some of those data asks that we had from not just communities, but from a wide swath practitioners and researchers, and I'm not talking specific to Nova Scotia. We had requests from all over Canada for data that was emerging in Nova Scotia that we simply couldn't provide, because, you know, in those early days, in particular, those few cases that we had, it was really important that we protect the identity of folks who are receiving health services.
So Lisa, you are certainly last but not least here. So what were you seeing in long-term care?
Yeah, and I think I agree with Gary that it seems like a long time ago, and also seems like just yesterday that we were back in, you know, March, April. The thing with long-term care, you know, we are used to having, we do have outbreaks, and there's always ethical challenges with outbreaks. But what we really found with this, it was tenfold, a hundredfold, the challenges we were facing. As an organization, we really pride ourselves on creating an environment for our seniors where they live their best life. They live on their own terms. They have a world of choices available to them. But when with the pandemic and the lack of epidemiological evidence, we were really forced to limit a lot of choices available to them. We were looking at placing the health and well-being of our community of residents over the individual freedoms of the residents, which is not something we are used to doing. During the first wave, again, with that lack of clarity on the virus, all we really knew for sure was that it was going to be devastating if it got into our homes. So that meant we really had to act strongly and quickly. So we stopped visits immediately. We removed our volunteers. We stopped our group recreation. These are all the things our residents enjoy. Huge ethical challenge there. We basically felt like we were taking away their quality of life for the sake of quantity of life. And didn't feel good. From the start, we really knew that we would have to ensure we were bringing back that quality as quickly as we could and as safely as we could. Even though, like, that quality we're bringing back, it might look different than what that quality of life was before. But we had to figure out a way to do it so that they weren't just being. They were actually able to still have the things they enjoy. The other issue we had related to the lack of visiting was the issue of palliative visits. We initially had to restrict those, and it never truly felt right to any of us. But with so much uncertainty, again, in those initial phases, we did have several situations where family members were not able to physically be with their loved one during their last moments. And that really hurt all of us. And we knew we had to change that quickly. The way we approached it was really we had a pandemic team that met every day virtually, looking at the latest information, and made changes right away as new information became available. The other thing we made sure to do was to keep those lines of communication wide open for residents and families, employees who had concerns regarding our approach. And we made sure we were listening to that. Now that there's more information going into a second wave, we feel like we are better prepared with ways we can still maintain those connections that are needed. We can still have visits safely now that we know a little bit more, keep recreation activities going, make use of our volunteers. They may just be helpful to us in a different way. That was kind of the resident-focused ethical challenge. I'd say the other big ethical challenge we had was our cohorting strategy. We created designated care areas for if or when we had a positive COVID case with one of our residents. And to create that true cohorting structure, we had employees designated to work strictly in those areas, so they wouldn't be working in their normal work environment. If a designated care area was opened, they would only be working there. So we provided them with accommodations and basically everything they would need to be safe and comfortable. But the truth is that by them working in those areas, it meant that they were going to be extended periods of time that they would be away from their families. And we might have been behind the scenes creating the safest scenarios possible, but it was not lost on us, the selflessness of these team members who volunteered to put themselves at risk leave their families for weeks at a time to make sure that our residents received the care, the comfort, the companionship even that they needed during this time. You know, being diagnosed with COVID as an elderly person, it can be devastating. You know, it's terrifying for them. It's terrifying for their families. And, you know, it was heartwarming to see people to be willing to put their name forward to work in these care areas, not really knowing even what we know now about the virus. I would say the approach with both of those ethical challenges that really worked for us was communication, that clear, transparent, frequent communication. When we looked at experiences across the world with senior living facilities that had these extreme outbreaks through their homes, what really struck us was that the complaints that you were hearing from families was that they didn't know what was going on. They weren't receiving enough communication. They didn't know the condition of their loved one in the home. So we knew that we'd have to have the trust of our residents, the families, the employees. They had to trust that we were working on these safe solutions, and then they had to see action, which is what they're seeing now going into a second wave. You know, these ethical struggles that we have, you can't just be okay with having these ethical struggles. You have to be working in the background to do something about them. So that was our experience.
All right, so thank you all for that. That was incredibly rich, and certainly something that I'm hearing from everyone is that even as the decisions were being made, you know, were felt to be sort of ethically the best possible, that none of those were easy, that it was, you know, the right thing still felt very, very hard to do. And I think that's something that we often see in the ethics context, but it, I think, was really driven home by a lot of the experiences that we've had. So I'm wondering for each of you, sort of what in the other panelists' experiences really resonated for you or made you think about other aspects of the response that have been challenging. So perhaps we'll go in reverse order, and you can start with you, Lisa, and what you heard in other folks' presentations.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely have a few notes here that I made. Certainly interesting experiences from Allison and Gary. I think Allison had mentioned about supply, so issues of running out of ventilators. I know when the other side of that with us, we were certainly well aware that the hospitals in our communities were or had potential to struggle. So we had to look at our skill set of our clinical teams at the homes to decide, you know, maybe we're not transferring a resident to hospital. I think initially, if a family member or a resident or even our employees felt, okay, this resident gets COVID, we're going to send them to the hospital. So we had to really look at that with our staff and say, you know, that's actually likely not to happen unless there's particular reason to do so. There's a lot of things that as nurses, as LPNs, as CCAs that we can do here, that we may have to practice our skills. We may have to brush up a little bit on some things that we wouldn't normally do in the home, and look at doing that here. You know, we do provide excellent palliative care. Not everybody needs to go to hospital for palliative care. We really need to have these open, frank discussions with family members ahead of time in case their loved one gets sick, to really think about what outcomes are possible, what everyone's comfortable with. The hospitals are certainly there. They're there when we need them. They will take our residents if they need to go. However, we need to be accountable, and we hear this over and over, we're all in this together. We need to be able to help as much as we can. Part of our structure with our designated care areas was that we would be able to, if we had to, provide some additional services that maybe we wouldn't typically do within our walls. So that was certainly something, Allison, that resonated with me from what you said. And I'll just say to Gary, when you mentioned about knowing what people need to do to self-isolate, but also knowing that some people don't have the means to do that, We had a similar situations in our homes with our residents who have dementia and can't understand the concept of isolation. So we really struggled with that. And we struggled with, we have homes with residents with dementia living alongside of residents without dementia, and to try to explain to them and their families why this person who may be symptomatic isn't always staying in their room, really having to communicate with them and the things that we're doing to still help keep them protected and the things that they can do to help keep themselves protected as well. Kind of a different take on what you said, but similar scenarios there for sure.
Yeah, Lisa talked a bit about communication and the need to be communicating regularly. And that reminded me of some communication challenges that we had. So, you know, one of the really important things that my program and staff pride itself on are communicating regularly and communicating the facts and building trust with communities who, you know, we're applying some pretty tough control measures to sometimes, or really prying into their personal lives and very intimate details of people's lives. And that requires that you build trust with people. And so, one of the ways that you do that is you communicate regularly and you communicate the facts. And one of the challenges that arose in the first wave, and I would say it continues to be a challenge, is the message keeps changing. And so with a novel virus, you communicate what you know when you know it. And the next day, what you know has changed quite significantly based on emerging international science. And so the fact that the messages kept changing early on was problematic for all kinds of reasons. And of course, I understand why. Another thing we pride ourselves on in the program that I work in, and I would say the organization I work for, is standardization and consistency. So the benefit of having a single provincial health authority, Nova Scotia Health, is that we can provide consistency of service, and so that no matter where you are in the province, you're getting the same service and you're getting the same messages from a very large and complex organization. And of course, in the first wave, and I would say it continues now, that message isn't always consistent because the scientific knowledge is emerging, and the way that filters through an organization like ours, it can take time, and there's sometimes many iterations of that, right? So it's very challenging when the science is emerging so rapidly. It creates all kinds of opportunities, I suppose, but also challenges with respect to how you communicate the message and when. Of course, you want to do that as quickly as possible, but I recall days where what we knew about the virus changed three times in a single day. And that's a harsh reality of a new virus and in a pandemic situation. And I can't say that I want to live through that again, but certainly it's there are opportunities in it, in that it really helped us look at ourselves and how the speed of information across the organization and what can we actually do to aid that and to make sure that our staff have the right information at the right time, but all kinds of challenges with that too.
Hey, and for you, Allison, things that really resonated?
Yeah, I think when I listened to both Gary and Lisa, particularly the decisions around, I don't want to say individual sacrifice, but in many ways, individual sacrifice for community well-being. We are, I think, as Nova Scotians, very community-oriented, and we understand that. But when that impacts an individual's freedoms and their choices, that's really, really tough. And I think we found ourselves in that position regularly at the Clinical Medical Advisory, where we were providing advice and guidance to our team members that was for the betterment of the community and meant that either staff or patients or physicians had to sacrifice what they were doing. And that was really hard. And it was challenging, to Gary's point with communication. That was the other thing that very much resonated with me. it is very difficult to communicate consistently when the message is constantly changing, not just to the public, but to our clinicians who are being regularly faced with complex environments. And understanding, particularly when I think about it, is our teams that are directly dealing with patients and families who are being faced with that. Why is X patient allowed to have a visitor, protecting their patient confidentiality, but why can't I come and see my visitor? Well, I heard so-and-so. And knowing that they need to be able to explain this information, but that's changing, it really put us in some challenging situations that it was hard. And you knew it was even harder for those that were dealing, for the team members that were dealing at the front lines.
So one thing that's certainly struck me about the experience of COVID generally, and particularly within healthcare, is it's a little bit like when everyone in the family gets sick at the same time, and there's no one left to dole out the pity, which is also necessary. And so in terms of thinking about, you know, there's been a lot of intersections and similarities for everyone, but also knowing that there wasn't that sort of coordinated effort throughout the healthcare system to help sort of deal and manage. So shifting a bit to thinking about sort of going forward, how do we, you know, work better, support each other better, and not reinvent wheels when, you know, folks are dealing with similar types of challenges across sectors, so that, you know, there's just a bit of breathing room for everyone, because certainly as everyone has acknowledged, it has taken a toll and a lot of sacrifice from folks throughout the healthcare system.
I think panel discussions like this are something that can help us. It's very easy, as we saw in the first wave, to focus inward or in your house, in your business, in your organization, as to what is going to work best for you. But I think sharing information, and again, that concept of we're all in this together, that we can actually help each other if we share information and understand the whys behind decisions. So I know initially it was a tough pill for us to swallow, no pun intended, but about us having to do some extra tasks, extra clinical activities within our homes. But if you approach that looking at, you know, if we don't do this, somebody that needs a ventilator might not get a ventilator. Somebody that, you know, really understanding why certain decisions are being made, and maybe how we can really help each other. It's really hearing each other's experiences and listening to the voice of those that it truly impacts. I know I was sitting at home in a home office throughout this pandemic, making decisions for people who are on the front lines, helping people with their hygiene care, helping feed residents. And I was making decisions, and our team was making decisions that were impacting them. So we really needed to hear the voices of the residents, the families, the employees. What does this actually look like when you're there with your 2 feet on the ground doing this work? Because that's the information we need to make the most appropriate decisions. And I think we can be surprised sometimes. They have fantastic ideas. You know, if you look at their true experiences, it can help us. It helps greatly in making decisions that are going to work and work for the long term, because the reality is we are likely to be in this for the long term.
Yeah, I would. I guess I would add to that I agree with what Lisa said around really listening to those people who the disease is impacting. So communities and residents and cases and their families. Totally agree with that. And those who do the work to support those people and listening to them and what their experiences are is so critically important. And at a time when information is really flowing from the top. And so, you know, I mentioned earlier around the communication and sometimes the communication changing 3 times a day. It's one thing to have the directive coming from, senior levels around here's what needs to be done based on, you know, the science has changed, or here's what we know now. And so here's the directive. And the actual ability to implement that directive and understanding from the staff who do that work every day, what the feasibility is of that. And so often, you know, the managers who I work with on a daily basis felt caught in the middle of those two things, what was being experienced with patients and cases and their families, and what the directive was based on, you know, what the emerging science is, and the truth is somewhere in the middle, perhaps, or maybe it's not the truth, but there's a balance to be achieved. Sometimes, not always, in those two things and those two viewpoints. And so, and often we don't take the time to understand what that frontline viewpoint is. And I think that's so important, because it's where an organization like ours interfaces with its community, and that's so important.
I think to your point, Gary and Lisa, it is the willingness to listen. And I know we overuse the term being agile and flexible, but as leaders, being the willingness to fail. And it doesn't mean the principles or the guidance is wrong. It's that implementation piece. And how do we be flexible on how that's implemented? As long as we're achieving A, which is our main priority, how that's achieved can be done in different ways depending on the resources at bay. And sometimes we're over prescriptive. And I think we learned quickly in this pandemic, we can't be over prescriptive. We need to set the guiding principles. They may change tomorrow, but how that's accomplished really has to be at a local level, because the nuances that are at each of our local communities are important. They have strengths and opportunities that, unless you're part of that community, you can't understand, and one blanket statement won't fit. So that does, though, come with communication and trust to be flexible and nimble. And I think in some cases we were able to do that really well in the first wave. And the second wave will provide its own level of challenge around that as well.
So a lot of what you're commenting on here strikes me as, you know, the challenge of responding to a wicked problem in a complex system with very limited resources of all sorts, human resources, physical resources, things like that. So again, situation where, you know, there are no easy or good answers, and we're really, you know, striving what is the least bad or most workable, because that's also certainly a consideration you've all mentioned here, option of the ones that are on the table. So moving from, you know, striving for the best we can to the good enough in the moment, sort of with what we've got. And I think recognizing that everyone's sort of in that that boat, and I think extending the compassion and benefit of the doubt to everyone, from the, you know, the senior decision makers down to the frontline workers, that sort of everyone is doing their best, and that we're just in a very, very difficult situation. And it strikes me too, from the ethics side, that as you've all highlighted, you know, the response was rife with ethical challenges and ethical challenges at the forefront, and that, you know, we don't have the ethics services and supports available to sort of be there all the time doing that. So really also a lot of folks who are having to do that ethics work without necessarily feeling that that's their, you know, comfortable place, or that that's what their expertise is in. So certainly my own thinking too has been how to provide support sort of, you know, as needed, that are really workable for folks who have very limited time. No one wants to read my, you know, 20-page treatise on how we should think about allocating resources, sort of thing. So really thinking about how do we all do, again, the best we can to help each other through the situation. So is there anything that you want to leave as a final comment on the discussion today, or anything we haven't yet brought up for consideration?
I think, Marika, it is just knowing we're all in this together, and that to the point here, having an opportunity to share experiences, share strategies, share failures is all really helpful. And the more we can collaborate, I think it's better for everybody, because to your point, resources, particularly our human resources, which are our greatest strength, but also our most finite resource, are very important to consider, and that we don't have enough of them. So we do need to be very thoughtful in that approach. And that includes ensuring that we bring the ethical lens to all these issues in a very thoughtful manner, and do the best we can with what we have.
Yeah, I would echo that. You know, the most important, it sounds cliche perhaps, but it is so true, that the most important thing we have to enable our response to this disease is the people who work in our organization. And I'm so reassured, you know, Lisa, you come from a different a different type of organization than I do, but I was so reassured by your comments about the staff and your recognition of how hard they work. And I think that, you know, the three of us would, or the four of us on this call would echo that, you know, the value we see in people who work so tirelessly to implement the directions and the decisions that are made is really quite incredible and heartwarming. And it's what we've got. And so paying really close attention to that and motivating and ensuring those folks get rest too is a vital part of how we respond to this on a go forward basis.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, ethics brings out the emotional side of people that not everyone is comfortable with. But I think it's really important that we recognize and don't forget the resiliency of all of us, of our communities, our residents, our patients in the hospital, and definitely our healthcare workers, and not just the healthcare workers, you know, the housekeeping staff, the servery, the dining staff, all of them that are working so hard. We don't want people to get complacent. We don't want them. We know we're all tired. We're all tired of this pandemic, but we are doing very well. And the reason we're doing very well is because people are following the rules. You know, we're paying attention to the public health guidance. And you know, we just had a meeting today in our organization about, okay, it's getting into December and people are going to start to lose their focus on pandemic. And, you know, we need to remind people, champion them that, yes, we've done a great job. We also need to keep doing a great job so that we can have these freedoms that we want to have and that we want our residents to have and our patients to have. And so I think I would just want to ensure that messaging keeps getting out there as well.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you all for sharing your expertise and hard-won expertise with us today. Discussions like this, I think, are really essential as we continue to grapple together with the many challenges that COVID keeps on presenting us with. So thank you so much for your time and your very thoughtful participation.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.